Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The Federal Reserve, the economy, and you. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Wall Street, the banks, business, and organized labor are all waiting to see if Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates tomorrow. They're only talking about a quarter of 1%, but that's a lot when rates are close to zero, as they've been for the past 9 years. Those who want to see an increase are worried about inflation. Those who want to keep things as they are say a hike would be bad for employment. We'll hear what's at stake for the prices you pay and the security of your job, not to mention business investment and profit. Today's talking point, military bases on foreign soil. Good or bad for America? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. Record low interest rates have helped lift the economy out of the Great Recession, but now there's worry about inflation. Would a rate increase threaten employment? This week, Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve are pondering a crucial decision. Today's talking point, there are 800 U.S. military bases located on foreign soil. The Pentagon and Congress claim they make America safer. Are they really worth what they cost? First, this news update, the two largest beer companies in the world are talking about joining forces to fend off competition. Acquisition of SAB Miller by the company that owns Anheuser-Busch would be the biggest merger in the history of the brewing industry. Bloomberg reporter Ruth David is covering the story from London. That's where SAB Miller is based. Ruth David, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let us unpack what may be a very complicated and surprising issue for our beer-drinking audience, which is that these major companies, SAB Miller in London and AB InBev, which owns Anheuser-Busch, are both located in Europe, AB InBev being in Belgium.
Absolutely. And I think some of the confusion may have been because so many of their brands are probably very popular in the U.S. as well, right? Whether you look at Budweiser or Stella Artois or Saab Miller's Castle Lager and Peroni and Foster's, I'm sure there are drinkers of that across continents.
And yet we see brewers and brewing going on with those labels here in this country.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, so it's interesting because the beer industry has for years used consolidation to stave off a slowdown in more established markets like Europe and the U.S. And I know there's been a huge trend toward craft brew, for instance, which takes away from some of these big brands. And drinkers are maybe looking at more wine and spirits or probably even drinking less in some markets.
On the other hand, we're talking big money here. AB InBev,
absolutely,
as I understand it, is worth, what, $93 billion?
Yes, it's probably even larger than that. That is Saab Miller's numbers you may be mentioning. AB InBev is about double that at $185 billion.
Whoa.
Yes.
Okay. So we really are talking big money.
Yeah, 161 billion or 162 billion euros. So.
And then SAB Miller is worth 93 billion, you think?
Yes. SAB Miller is worth about 90 billion. So it's pretty much double their size.
Well, now, the third largest is Heineken, and that's worth 29 billion. What are they worried about if they have so much more?
Well, so one of the things, and I think it's interesting, if you look at both companies' stock performances, so SAB Miller, for instance, had fallen 19% this year, and AB InBev has used acquisitions to boost their revenues in the last 10 years, but now they're at a place where growth is going to slow. And so in that situation, where do they expand? Who do they buy? And how do they consolidate to help them keep shareholders happy over the next 5 to 10 years? So an acquisition of SAB Miller is something that the industry, at least, I know for beer drinkers this might come as a surprise, but the industry has been predicting that this might happen for a while. And it's kind of a running joke in Europe that we'd been asking about this deal so much that, you know, you took your eyes off the ball for 5 minutes and they announced it.
If they merge, will all the beer begin to taste the same?
I should hope not.
And maybe they hope not, too, and they certainly won't.
They
don't want us to think that. Well, what about the craft brewers? You mentioned them. How big are they in comparison to these massive companies we're talking about?
I mean, if you look at the fact that we were talking about Heineken, which is, you know, the largest after them, and it's only $29 billion, these companies are very small. And, I mean, they're growing really fast, but they're growing from a very small base. So I don't even think they're at a stage where they can think of competing. Maybe the bigger companies would at some stage think, well, why don't we add craft brewing to our repertoire and might acquire them? But they're not, I mean, standalone, they're not at a place where they can threaten any of the big guys.
Are there parts of the world, in addition to the United States and Europe, where the merged company could really make some inroads?
Yes. So, I mean, because they are some of the few companies that don't really have so many geographical, overlaps. So they might be, so ABI might get more in Asia, they might get more in Africa, and so Africa, for instance, accounts for about $7 billion of SAB Miller's revenues. And with the acquisition, AB InBev gets access to that.
Meantime, there's antitrust issues and no actual announcement of a merger has been made.
Absolutely. But the takeover panel rules in the UK are very strict. So yesterday there was some speculation in the media, nothing substantiated. The stock started going up and the companies had to come out with a statement today. And just even to say there's been a very preliminary approach, so there's no formal offer, but they had to come out with a statement because of the way the takeover panel rules are here.
Okay.
And they're probably the strictest market in the world, or one of the strictest markets, definitely.
All right. We'll see if it happens and if we get one huge beer company supplying so much of the world. Ruth David, good to have you with us on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, the Federal Reserve, the economy, and you. This is To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Not since the Great Depression have interest rates been so low for so long, close to zero for the past 9 years. As the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee meets this week, there is growing pressure for change, and there's growing pressure for maintaining the status quo. Janet Yellen is caught in the middle. Zachary Wombrot is a financial reporter for Politico. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit more about what's going on this week.
So we will learn tomorrow whether or not the Federal Reserve is going to start raising interest rates for the first time in several years. If you go back to the end of 2008, when we were in the middle of the global financial crisis, they lowered rates as a means to help keep the economy going and help stimulate the economy. And right now we're at a point where the job market has improved since then. That's looking like it's in good shape, and that could be a reason to start raising rates again, maybe tapping the brake a little bit on the economy, because the Fed's other mandate is to also attack inflation, which is less of a problem now, and so that's kind of a countervailing force.
There are these two things that the Fed has to be concerned about, inflation on the one hand and the job market on the other. Do they have to try to maintain a balance? Is that the idea?
I think they just want to stave off one inflation getting out of control. So I think that's the big challenge. And right now, inflation is well below a 2% target that they look at. I think it's somewhere in 0.3%. So it's a real challenge that they have.
What about the pressure from the other side, particularly from liberal Democrats, who, as I understand it, had something to do with Janet Yellen getting her job?
Yeah, exactly. So in recent weeks, you've had top members of the Senate Banking Committee and House Financial Services, Democrats, who were big advocates for Janet Yellen to take the job. They've been telling her, maybe err on the side of not raising rates. And this is significant because, if you go back a couple years, there was this discussion about whether it would be Larry Summers or Janet Yellen, and liberals were uncomfortable with Larry Summers because he was associated with some deregulatory policies during the Clinton administration. And now they're telling Janet Yellen, the recovery hasn't reached enough workers, wages aren't growing enough, there's still people who are being left out of the recovery, maybe just keep the low rates going for a little bit longer.
Who's advocating for an increase?
You have, officials at the Fed who are certainly advocating for an increase. Republicans, in recent years have definitely been very public about the idea that the Fed should get out of intervening in the markets to the extent it has, whether it was through, buying bonds, but also keeping rates low. And so that is some other pressure that the Fed is feeling.
Is this traditional that there is this partisan difference and pressure on the chair of the Fed from supporters as opposed to people who were not in favor of that person's appointment?
Well, I think I think skepticism of the Fed is pretty bipartisan if you go back through history, and there's definitely plenty of examples of Democrats going against the Fed chair. I mean, I talked to Paul Volcker earlier this week, and he was recalling how, there was a congressman when he was the Fed chair, trying to impeach him when he was raising rates.
Okay. So obviously then, politics does play a role in the Fed. Zachary Warmbrot again with Politico. Adi Barkan is director of the Fed Up campaign at the Center for Popular Democracy, which promotes pro-worker, pro-immigrant, racial and economic justice and that kind of an agenda. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
So what then are people such as Maxine Waters and the senator from New Jersey telling Janet Yellen, and what's the basis for it?
Well, the basic question here is what kind of an economy do we want to build? Do we want to build an economy in which wages are rising for most working families, or are we happy with the kind of economy we've got today where wages have been flat and most workers are not benefiting from the recovery? With all due respect to Zach, he said the job market is kind of, it's in good shape right now, and it's certainly better than it was in 2008. But the truth is that for the vast majority of working families, wages have been flat for 15 years. And so we think that, in fact, the Fed, the labor market has a long way to go, and it would be crazy for the Federal Reserve to intentionally slow down the economy tomorrow. Right. And we shouldn't mince words about it. That's what the purpose of raising interest rates is. It's to slow down the economy, to make it harder for businesses to create jobs and to prevent wages from rising. And I think when we put it in those terms, it becomes a lot, the choice becomes a lot more stark.
Let me introduce Mark Zandi, who's chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
What's the case for raising interest rates?
Well, I would agree with the previous caller's goal, that is to get wage growth up. It has been very depressed for many, many years, and so I think that is a very laudable goal. But I think the key is to sustain that sustainable economic growth, strong economic growth that maintains a very low rate of unemployment, underemployment for long periods of time. And while it's a matter of judgment and a matter of significant debate, my sense is that at this point, given what's going on in the labor market and how quickly we're creating jobs and the labor market is tightening, it makes sense at this point to begin raising rates. And you just need to consider that what we're talking about here is an increase in interest rates from zero, that's where they are effectively today, to something like somewhere between a quarter and a half a point. So still incredibly low interest rates that still would be very, very supportive of a very strong job market. So the goal is right. I'm all on board with it. I agree with it. I just think, from my perspective, it would be better for the economy longer run and for workers and wages longer run to begin what I would call normalizing interest rates.
Is there any worry really about inflation if the target is 2% and we're now at 0.3%?
Not today, no, and probably not a year from now or 2 years from now, so certainly not, no. So we should be focused on maintaining strong job growth and getting unemployment and underemployment down. But, at the current pace of job growth, it's pretty clear that we will be back to full employment by this time next year and a couple years down the road. And this is a forecast, but this is what the Federal Reserve has to do when setting monetary policy today. 2 years from now, I think the economy will be growing very strongly. Wage growth will be strong. And interest rates, given that, should be off of zero. That they should not be zero. It's time to begin to normalize rates. And let me just say, a healthy economy, one that's functioning well, performing well for everybody, for workers, for businesses, and everyone in between, is one where interest rates are not at zero. Zero is not healthy. Interest rates that are more consistent with what we consider to be a healthy economy would be something closer to 3.5% to 4%. So we're not talking about, jacking up interest rates quickly. We're just getting them off of zero.
So, Andy Barkin, back to you with the Fed Up campaign. What about that? A healthy economy requires something higher than zero. Presumably, there wouldn't be any way to fix things if they began to go wrong, if you didn't have interest rates higher than they are now. You're not confident that the economy will continue to increase and be good for labor if the interest rates are only up to a quarter or a half a point?
Well, so I don't think that that a quarter point change will dramatically impact the economy. But the question is, what does that say about the Fed's plan? And I think what it says is that the Fed is basically happy with where we're heading and thinks that they can start slowing it down. You don't take your foot off the gas, hundreds of miles from your destination, if you think that you still have a lot of work to get there. And so our sense is, there's plenty of time to wait and to raise interest rates once wages do pick up, once we actually do reach full employment. With, Mark just said, inflation's not going to reach 2% for 2 years. There's no reason to raise before then. We've had 7 years in which wages have been stagnant and unemployment has been higher than what the Fed wants, and in which inflation has been lower. We've had 30 years, frankly, in which we've had rising inequality and disparities. We need to have some catch-up growth. Wages should actually probably be rising faster than productivity growth so that working families can make up some of the ground they've lost over recent decades. The fundamental question you asked earlier, Warren, is Federal Reserve policy a matter of politics? Has it always been a matter of politics? And the basic question is, this is a question about kind of the distribution of power between workers and employers in our economy. And for basically 35 years since Paul Volcker, the Federal Reserve has set policy to favor employers, and that's one reason why and to have a weak labor market, and that's one reason why we've seen such stagnant wages and rising inequality. And if we want to change that, if we really want to change the American economy, we need a tight labor market. And the kind of it feels like it's getting better complacency, with all due respect to Mark, who I highly admire, I think kind of misreads the gravity of the challenge that the American economy faces.
So, Mark Zandi, what do you say to that, particularly the idea that since Paul Volcker, that's been a long time, the Fed has, in fact, favored employers?
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that argument. I do think that Volcker and Chairman Greenspan, they did operate a policy that worked to run a cold economy, an economy where unemployment was generally high, and that brought down wage growth. And, of course, their problem back 25 years ago was was inflation. That was a real problem, and so they had to work against that, and so that policy was probably a pretty good one. But it did hammer working Americans and did depress wage growth. And I'm all for running the economy going forward, at least for a considerable period, on what I would call the hot side, where you have unemployment that's below what you consider to be full employment, so that wage growth is very strong. I'm all in on that. I agree. It's just, what is the best way of achieving that over the longer run? The thing I really worry about is that if we aren't vigilant and begin to normalize interest rates soon, that we will run into a period, and it will be a year or two down the road, when things will be too hot and wage and price pressure is too significant. The Fed will have to ramp up interest rates and undermine the economy. And, you know, that sounds like, a long chain of events, but that's typically what happens. We don't want that. That's not good for anybody. That's not good for business. That's not good for American workers. So we need moderation. And I hear the other side, and there's a lot I agree with. But it's my sense that at this point, given what's going on in our economy, we want to slowly but surely normalize interest rates, get them to a point where it is consistent with a healthy economy. We're a long way from that.
Adi Barkin, you have met, as I understand it, with some members of the Federal Reserve. I don't know if Janet Yellen was one of them, but if so, what did you get from that?
Yeah, I have. So we sat down. We brought a coalition of about 25 workers to sit down with Janet Yellen and Stanley Fischer and Lael Brainard and Jerome Powell in Washington, D.C. back in November. Since then, we've sat down with six of the 12 regional presidents around the country. We've got a couple other meetings scheduled in the next month. And they've been fantastic conversations. And these conversations have offered Federal Reserve officials the opportunity to hear from regular workers and unemployed people who are trying to be workers. Our impression has been that these conversations have been really meaningful. The kind of feedback we've gotten from Fed officials has been very positive. And our sense is that there aren't enough voices of working families in these conversations. They are debates primarily among bankers and elites. Occasionally, academics' voices get heard in the conversation, although not enough. The corporate boards that manage all of these regional feds are run by bank presidents and corporate officials. Some of the most important economic officials in the country are appointed by private sector banks. And we think that's a real problem, and that actually explains why we've had this history of a Fed that benefits employers and bankers rather than workers. And ultimately, that's going to need to change if we want a central bank that actually advances the public interest of most Americans.
Let me go back to Zachary Wambrot of Politico on this issue of politics. Are Democrats in Congress arguing that, in fact, the deck is stacked in favor of the employers, the elites, as we've just heard them describe, the people on the boards and the bankers? And are they trying to make a case as well?
Certainly. I think that's definitely a theme we keep seeing in a number of areas, including this. If you look at the letter that Senator Sherrod Brown and Congresswoman Maxine Waters sent to Yellen last month, they make it very clear that the workers and minority communities are not benefiting as much as they should be from the recovery. So I think there is definitely an element of a theme of income inequality, which is something that Chair Yellen has touched on and which I think, pleases some of these people who are now telling her to wait a little bit on raising rates.
So do you think then that the signs are from her that she would wait? And she's indicated in the past that September might be the time.
No, I don't think she sent signals that September isn't the time. The Fed, they say they're data driven, and so I think they're going to look at the numbers. I haven't heard anything that anyone said that would indicate that she's going to bend to the political pressure.
Okay, let's get back onto that issue as we rejoin our conversation after we take a very brief break for station identification. We're going to quickly go away for that. Then on our talking point later, we'll talk about U.S. military bases on foreign soil. There are 800 of them. Are they making America safer, or are they making war more likely than ever? We'll talk about that once again on our talking point. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Hey, Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, once again talking about the Federal Reserve and market rates almost at zero for 9 years. Is this the time to begin to increase them, even by just a quarter of a percent or a half a percent, in order to sort of maintain the economy? Mark Zandi, quickly back to you with Moody's Analytics. Hasn't the chair, Janet Yellen, indicated that this would be the year? Wasn't it thought that perhaps that meant September, but wasn't there then concern about the Chinese problems in with its economy and with Wall Street's worries that led people to think that it'll be put off?
Yeah, I think you got that right. I think she's strongly indicated that everything would be in place at some point this time, some point this year, to raise interest rates, to begin raising interest rates. The exact timing of that, whether it's this meeting tomorrow or whether it's in October when they meet or December, that's kind of data dependent. Depends on what's going on in with regard to China, with regard to financial markets. So I think the volatility in financial markets probably has entered into their thinking and may delay the precise date when they actually begin raising rates. And maybe it's not tomorrow, but it'll be October or December. But every indication is that they'll begin raising rates this year. Yes.
Let me bring another voice into this conversation. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's an independent left-of-center economic research organization that's based in Washington. Dean Baker, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Do you think it's inevitable that interest rates will go up sometime this year?
Well, I don't think it's all inevitable they'll go up sometime this year. I mean, we have had a situation where the rate hikes that people have been expecting keep getting put off for the simple reason the economy is weaker than people had expected. I mean, you know, we could look at the unemployment numbers, and those are relatively low in the scheme of things, but the fact is that the employment numbers, if we look at the number of people working, we're still down by somewhere around 4 to 5 million from what we would have expected based on the pre-recession trend. And that's taking account of, you know, we know about the aging baby boomers retiring. We know about that. So we're down quite a lot. And if you look at other measures, you know, the quit rates, the percentage of people who are prepared to quit their job, comfortable, and get a new job, that's still very low. It's at recession levels by any standard measure. People working part-time because they can't get full-time employment, it's one-third higher than any point in the last recession. So by a whole range of measures, the labor market's very weak, and we've had relatively strong monthly job growth, but that still takes a very long time to make up 4 to 5 million jobs. So to my view, we have a lot of room to go and grow, and the economy has not been growing all that rapidly. We've been looking at growth, you know, maybe this year will be a little over 2%. That's roughly in line with the economy's potential. We're not making up ground. So we've had a series of, you know, occasions where growth has come in consistently below expectations. We've had a series of negative disappointments elsewhere in the world, in the sense of weaker growth, first in Europe and now it seems in China. And these are reasons that the Fed has put off rate hikes in the past, and I don't take it at all as a foregone conclusion they're going to hike this year. They have good reasons to wait. And, you know, again, the point that, you know, everyone agrees on, you know, Mark and AD, you know, everyone agrees on this, the concern, of course, is inflation. You know, somewhere down the road we'll get inflation. But that's a very, very distant story. So you're sort of saying, well, why raise rates now when everyone agrees inflation's nowhere in sight and, you know, it doesn't just come up out of the blue. It's not that we'll wake up one morning and suddenly have exploding inflation. There's no story you could tell that we get that. So what's the rush? Why would we deliberately slow the economy and keep people from getting jobs?
What about Mark Zandi's point about moderation, that raise it a little bit now and you won't throw things into a turmoil, but you will be prepared then to do something in the event that they need to be lowered again?
Well, I guess I'd say a few points on that. First off, you know, I would agree, you know, a quarter point, not a big deal. The big issue is whether, you know, whether we get this story, okay, we're raising a quarter point in September or maybe it'll be in December, and we're on a path to get to 2 or get to 3 over the next, you know, year, year and a half, and, you know, that's what we're going to do, that will have a big impact. So I'm not going to say quarter point's the end of the world. I don't want to see it, but that's not the end of the world. It seems to me it's just the wrong way. Second point, you know, normalizing, we don't have a normal economy. So as much, you know, we would all love to say we have a normal economy, and then, you know, you'd have a 2.5-3% federal funds rate, as Mark said. That's right. But having a 3% federal funds rate doesn't give us a normal economy. So the main point here is to get the normal economy first, and we're a long way from that. So, you know, that seems to be getting things backward in my view. The third point is it's not quite true to say the Fed can't do anything. It can't lower the interest rate. Obviously, we're at zero. We can't lower the interest rate. But, of course, the Fed did quantitative easing. And, you know, again, that's not the preferred policy. We'd love to be in a world where the Fed could boost the economy just by lowering the federal funds rate. And, you know, certainly in normal times, you know, you go back to the recession that we had in 2001 or in 1990, that's what the Fed did. I mean, that's the way we ordinarily think of monetary policy is working. But in the event that, you know, the economy were to be hit by something unexpectedly, why would we not have more quantitative easing? I mean, I don't really see a good argument. So, again, that's not the preferred situation. We don't want to be there. But whether we like it or not, you know, this is where we are. We have a very weak labor market, and that looks likely to continue to be the case for some time into the future.
And what exactly is quantitative easing?
Oh, I'm sorry. Quantitative easing, this is the policy that was adopted under Ben Bernanke, I think first in 2009, when he started buying up long-term bonds. So typically, the Fed acts simply in the short-term market. They're simply overnight money funds. This is when we're talking about the federal funds rate. We're looking at the rate that banks pay for overnight deposits, they borrowing reserves from each other. That's not a market you and I are in. That's what the banks are in to meet their reserve requirements. What the Fed did in the recession, because we were in such a severe slump and they'd already pushed the federal funds rate to zero, was they began directly acting on long-term interest rates by buying up treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities, and that's what is referred to as quantitative easing. And we have, I should know the exact number, but somewhere over $3 trillion in assets now as a result of that policy. But in the event we were suddenly to see the economy take another hit, to my view, I mean, there's not an obvious reason why the Fed couldn't go back and, you know, have another half trillion, trillion again. Not what you want to do, but on the other hand, if the alternative is a lot of unemployment and a very weak economy, that's what you do.
Mark Zandi, what do you say to that?
Well, I'd say a couple things. First, sort of my perspective on the economy and job market are more optimistic, upbeat. I think the labor market's doing pretty well, created 3 million jobs over the past year. I mean, the last time we did that was in the height of the technology boom in the late 1990s. And the jobs are across the board. There's a lot of low-paying, but there's a lot of high-paying, middle-paying, all kinds of jobs, because that's a lot of jobs. And at that pace, we're absorbing the unemployed and underemployed pretty quickly. And if you just do a little bit of trending, you know, we will be back to full employment by this time next year, and we will get that stronger wage growth. Again, this is a forecast, but that's what the Federal Reserve has to do when setting monetary policy today. The other thing I'd say, you know, QE, quantitative easing, yeah, we can go down that path, but here's the problem. It's not very effective, and I think all of the research and even the Fed members would tell you that that's not a particularly good way of trying to support the economy. And so if you get into that situation where you're QEing again, you know, that may not really help all that much. So we really don't want that. That would be a, you know, if we got back into that spot, that would be a pretty difficult spot. So I don't think that's really going to be the answer here. So it's really, really important, you know, to – and I agree with Dean. We're not. It's not back to normal. When you have a 0% interest rate, that's just not normal. That's not consistent with a healthy economy. And I agree. We need a better job market to get those interest rates up to something closer to normal. But we're well on our way. This job market is, you know, it's a train that's moving down the tracks pretty fast, and it all feels pretty good to me.
Dean Baker, back to you. We've been talking about this on sort of a macro level. What does it mean to individuals and people who are trying to make a go of it on the ground in terms of wages and their ability to buy cars, get their mortgages, and things of that kind?
Yeah, well, this is a point Audie had made earlier, that we still have not seen any substantial wage growth. There was some wage growth over the last year, not because wages had sped up, but because we saw a collapse in oil prices, gas prices, which, you know, obviously is good news from the standpoint of those of us, you know, we pay our energy bills and pay for our gasoline. But I don't think anyone expects that to continue. So in other words, it was sort of a one-time gain. That was good news. But, you know, wage growth itself, there's been basically no acceleration wage growth. It's been at roughly 2% nominal. And, you know, with the inflation rate expected to come in a little bit less than that, that's very, very little wage growth. And, you know, important point to understand with the unemployment rate, there's sort of a huge class race bias in who ends up being unemployed. So Good rule of thumb, the unemployment rate for African Americans is going to be twice the unemployment rate for whites. Currently, the unemployment rate for blacks is somewhere close to 10%. For black teens, it's typically 6-1. So these are really good reasons as to why you would want to see the unemployment rate come down, because it disproportionately benefits those at the bottom. I should also point out this is in terms of wage increases as well. So when you get a lower unemployment rate, we go to the late 90s and we saw the unemployment rate fall to 4%, something I should point out that almost no economist thought was possible without, you know, inflation being a big problem. We saw at that point we had good wage growth at the middle and the bottom of the income distribution, the only time in the last 40 years. So that's, again, a reason why I think it's extremely important to try and push as far as we can to get the unemployment rate as low as we can, and, you know, for that reason, not to move prematurely to raise rates and slow the economy.
Zachary Wormbrot, when we start talking this way, it begins to, again, raise political issues. There hasn't been, as I understand it, an increase in interest rates during a presidential election year for a long, long time. Is that going to play a role, do you think, with Janet Yellen and the other members of the Fed?
I haven't seen any indication that they're taking the election into account. But to be sure, whatever decision they make tomorrow will definitely become part of the presidential debate. You haven't heard a lot of specific comments, but I mean, you've heard Republicans, you know, like Donald Trump and Chris Christie, you know, criticize keeping rates low. And of course, you probably remember that Rick Perry called Ben Bernanke treasonous during his first presidential run, but he's no longer in the race. But if you look back at, you know, Paul Volcker, some would argue that, you know, his attempts to fight inflation through raising rates, helped keep Carter from winning re-election, and, you know, President H.W. Bush also placed some of the blame on Alan Greenspan for him not winning re-election.
So do you think that the contributors to presidential campaigns are looking at what the candidates are saying about this and moving accordingly?
I think there's very broad banking and financial issues that they're paying attention to. I haven't seen any indication that people are giving money to one candidate or the other based on who they might put in the Federal Reserve.
Andy Barkin, back to you with the Center for Popular Democracy. Do the Democrats pretty much agree on the issues that we've been hearing?
Well, I think Democrats very clearly agree that the economy is not strong enough. Wages should be higher, and we need more jobs. And I think, frankly, the Republicans would agree with that, too. Jeb Bush has said he wants to see wage growth in America and much higher GDP growth. I think, you know, frankly, only in the world of Federal Reserve observers and reporters could there be a debate about whether the economy is healthy or not. Americans kind of largely agree. You look at the polling, the economy is terrible. Everybody's in favor of more wages and higher wages and more jobs. And so, you know, with again, I think Mark's argument that we should raise interest rates so that we can later reduce them if we need to is basically saying we need to slow the economy down now a little bit so that in the future we can raise it. And I agree, for some of us, myself included, the economy is doing quite well. But black underemployment is 20% right now. Dean cited a few of the other statistics about massive racial disparities. So I think that's going to be the theme of the presidential election, that the economy is not strong enough. And I think in that context, it would be very strange for the Fed to say, okay, we're done, all's well.
So, Mark Zondi, is this a loser from a political standpoint?
From the Fed's perspective, no, I don't think I agree that the politics of this are not really in the Federal Reserve's thinking. I mean, they're focused on having a strong economy, lots of jobs, and stronger wage growth with low inflation. That's their mandate, and I think that's what they're focused on, and I don't think they're going to be swayed by the politics of it. Let me just quickly say, I'm not arguing that the Fed should raise rates today so that they might be able to lower them tomorrow if something goes wrong. That's not my argument. I've heard that argument, but I think it's a pretty strained one. My view is that we want to have a strong economy for as long as possible, and it's a balance of risk. I mean, if the Federal Reserve moves too quickly and undermines the economy, that's a bad thing. But it's also a bad thing if they wait too long and then they ultimately have to raise rates too quickly and undermine the economy. We need to strike a balance. It's a matter of judgment. No doubt that's why you have smart people at the Fed debate this and think about it very carefully, because it is a matter of judgment ultimately. But at this point, it's my judgment, you know, if I were sitting on the Fed, I'd argue that, you know, it's time to begin raising rates, get them off of zero. Let's get going here. We don't have to raise them quickly after that. Let's see what happens. But that's the policy that in the long run will benefit American workers the most. It'll keep unemployment lower for longer and get their wage growth up stronger for longer.
All right. Well, the Open Market Committee meeting has begun. It'll be winding up tomorrow, and we'll know then, at least for the moment, what the next decision will be. Thank you all for being on our program. Mark Zandi with Moody's Analytics, Adi Barkin with the Center for Popular Democracy, Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Zachary Wambrot with Politico. Great to have you all on our show. The U.S. maintains some 800 military bases on foreign soil. Are they worth what they cost? We'll get some answers to that question in a moment on today's Talking Point.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Well, and I'll be back with today's Talking Point. Diego Garcia is a tiny island in the Indian Ocean. David Vine discovered that the entire indigenous population was removed in the 1960s to make way for a massive American military base. His research into how that happened led to the book called Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. David Vine, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much, Warren. It's a pleasure.
Let's start with Diego Garcia. What happened there?
Diego Garcia is a little-known story in the United States. It's an island smack dab in the middle of the Indian Ocean where the U.S. military has a very large and significant military base. The only reason the military has that base is that, as you said, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the U.S. and British governments forcibly removed the entire indigenous people of Diego Garcia and deported them 1,200 miles away to the western Indian Ocean. Britain controls Diego Garcia, but it is fundamentally a U.S. base, and the people have been living now in exile for more than 40 years, struggling to get back to their homeland. And meanwhile, the U.S. government has largely or almost entirely been silent on the matter.
What is the advantage of having the base on Diego Garcia?
Well, the military likes having the base because while it is very isolated in the Indian Ocean, it's 1,000 miles from the nearest landmass, India, it gives them the ability to strike targets over a wide swath of the globe, from southern Africa to the Middle East to South Asia and Southeast Asia. But it's the Middle East in particular that Diego Garcia has been helpful for the military in assisting in both the 1991 war in Iraq and the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, as well as the 2001 invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. So it's played a critical role in a series of wars in the greater Middle East.
How do other countries in the region feel about it?
It's a good question. There was opposition, certainly, and concern from India in particular when the base was created in the early 1970s. Largely, most neighboring governments have remained relatively silent. Largely, my sense is they don't want to pick a fight over this isolated island. And very few governments have, or individuals for that matter, have come to speak out on behalf of the exiled people. The Chagosians, they're called. The people have largely been struggling in anonymity. And there is a growing movement, I'm happy to report, of folks in the United States and Britain and around the world that are coming to support them. But Diego Garcia is a far underreported story and human rights abuse, as I would say.
All right. There are 800 foreign military bases being run by the United States, or bases on foreign soil, I should say. Are they all like Diego Garcia?
They're not. There's a wide range in that figure of 800. And the figure comes from a Pentagon list. Every year, the Pentagon puts together a list of its bases. And The last list indicated that there were 686 base sites outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C., but the list excludes numerous well-known bases like those in Kuwait and secretive and secret bases. So by my best estimate, after 14 years of research examining these U.S. bases overseas and their global impacts, my best estimate puts a good figure at 800. And they range from bases that are like Diego Garcia, which looks like a small American town plopped down on a gorgeous tropical island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, to much smaller bases. There are also even far bigger bases that are really city-sized bases like you'd find in Germany and Japan and South Korea and Italy. They're come complete with schools and housing, hospitals, fast food, bowling alleys. And then there were bases at the other end of the spectrum, some of which are now called lily pad bases or cooperative security locations. These are very small, typically have maybe 200, 300 troops. Sometimes they host drones. Often special forces troops operate from them. And they're often found in parts of the world where the United States has not had a military presence, and frankly, where most people in the United States have no clue we have a military presence. Places like Djibouti, where there actually is a larger base as well as Burkina Faso, Kenya, throughout Africa, also parts of Central Europe and Eastern Europe and Asia.
So there are all kinds of different bases then with different purposes, I gather, and some of them are in places we know very well, like Naples.
That's right. That's one of the long-standing bases. And most of this collection of 800 bases, they date to World War II and the early days of the Cold War. There are some bases that go back to the 19th century, like bases in Guam and Guantanamo Bay, which is probably the best-known base overseas. But most of them are frankly, relics of the Cold War. They're bases that were built or occupied during World War II or the early days of the Cold War, places like Naples, where there's a very large base, really a collection of bases, including a new one that has been built in the last decade and a half. In my book, Base Nation, I explain how the base was built basically in the heartland of the Neapolitan mafia, the Camorra, which more or less guaranteed that the mafia, the Camorra, would be involved in the construction of the base one way or another. And this is actually part of a long pattern of relationship between the Navy and the mafia, both that in around Naples and the mafia in Sicily.
So what does all this cost?
It's a good question, and the Pentagon puts the figure around $22-21 billion a year in recent years, and that's a considerable figure. That's a very larger than the budget of several government agencies. But I took a deep dive into the details of Pentagon budget documents to try to figure out whether that in fact does capture the total costs of bases and troops overseas. The only other estimate showed the total figure at $250 billion, so quite a discrepancy. And after several years of research, my best estimate is that we are spending around $85 billion a year maintaining troops and bases outside the United States. And that actually doesn't count the bases and troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we still have bases and troops. And if you include that, the total reaches around $156 billion a year. And that's a conservative estimate, and just at that is larger than the budget of any government agency, with the exception of the Department of Defense.
The subtitle of your book is How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. How do they harm America?
I think beginning with the costs, I think very few people know anything of these bases. I certainly didn't before I started this research 14 years ago. But the costs, the billions of dollars were plowing into building and maintaining these bases, and have been for more than 70 years, a very substantial infrastructure of bases that actually is larger than the collection of bases that any other people or nation or empire in world history has possessed. And we need only think of the infrastructure in the United States, I think, that has been crumbling in recent years while we've been building up and maintaining this very robust infrastructure of bases, many of them in places like in Europe that were designed to counteract the Soviet Union and protect Western Europe from the supposed Soviet threat. The Cold War is now more than two decades past us, and the Soviet Union long ago dissolved, the bases have not all disappeared. Many of them, in Germany alone, we have 174 base sites, according to the Pentagon. Italy, 50. So I think we have to begin by looking at the costs, but they also fundamentally undermine U.S. national security, in my mind, by in many ways being counterproductive. In places like the Middle East in particular, we see a direct correlation between the presence of U.S. bases and troops and radicalization, al-Qaeda recruitment in particular. Osama bin Laden's professed motivation for the 9/11 attacks was one of them, was the presence of U.S. bases and troops in the Muslim holy lands of Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. We see since those attacks that the presence of U.S. bases and troops has actually built up in that time and has only led to further radicalization that would and is creating more people who would wish to take up arms against the United States. So it's actually endangering U.S. citizens and the United States in many ways.
And you argue, we don't have a lot of time left, but you argue that there's so much mobility now on the part of armed forces that we could, in fact, deal with our security issues by keeping people here in this country and moving them to places around the world where they might be needed.
That's exactly right. And that's why people across the political spectrum, I'm happy to report, have been growing in their questioning of this really entrenched and unquestioned tenet of our foreign policy. The U.S. military, because of its technological capabilities and power, can deploy its forces from bases in the United States to most anywhere just as fast or almost as fast as from any base overseas. So the strategic value of maintaining bases overseas has declined significantly. And that's why there are a growing number of people looking at alternatives and beginning to argue that, you know what,
okay,
many of these bases aren't necessary.
The book, once again, Base Nation, How the U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. The author is David Vine. He's an associate professor of anthropology at American University. Thanks so much for being on our program.
No, thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.